Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, supporting the next generation of farmers with the Fresh Roots Young and Beginning Farmer Program, offering lending assistance and learning incentives to equip today's newest farmers for a healthy start in their farming careers.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 20th day of November 2018. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets and supply of corn and soybeans across the planet. We'll do that with Ag Resource Company's Bill Turney. I spoke with him earlier in this month at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City. And then we'll hear from the chair of the World Agricultural Outlook Board. They're responsible for putting together the monthly WASDE, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, and the changes that came in this November estimate as it relates to the number of bushels of corn the Chinese have on hand. It more than doubled, some 5.8 billion bushels more on the global marketplace available. Well, not really available out of China, but certainly that go into the supply and demand tables. And his name is Seth Meyer. We'll talk with him about those numbers and changes. And we'll do all of that right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, naturally, I am out of the office today hosting the Farm Assets Conference in Normal, Illinois. If you weren't able to make it, we'll have some of that conference available for you online maybe in a couple of weeks, but you'll be able to hear parts of it during the Thanksgiving edition of the Closing Market Report right here on this radio program, and then on Friday of this week. Of course, the markets are closed on Thanksgiving Day. They are open on Friday, but no markets here on our home station on that day, as the university is on holiday that day. And frankly, I just decide year in and year out that I want to spend that day with my family. So we will have a program, but we will not have an update of the marketplace until we get back to Monday, that after the Thanksgiving holiday. One other note, I've stopped talking to you about the Farm Assets Conference, but you will want to visit the Farm Doc Daily website, because the Farm Economic Summits are coming up. Those will be at the end of the month of December, just prior to the week of Christmas, across the state of Illinois in Mount Vernon, Springfield, Peoria, DeKalb, and Champaign. You can find the details on the Illinois Farm Economic Summits online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night, or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, supporting the next generation of farmers with the Fresh Roots Young and Beginning Farmer Program, offering lending assistance and learning incentives to equip today's newest farmers for a healthy start in their farming careers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this 20th day of November. I'm out of the office hosting the Farm Assets Conference. Let's go back about a week and a half now to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City. Two things happened that week. There was a WASDE report in which the United States Department of Agriculture updated its world and global stocks with some brand new numbers from the Chinese government. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Seth Myers at USDA about why that happens and how they put it into context. But first, I want to rerun an interview you heard on Commodity Week with Bill Turney. Now, this interview was done just prior to those WASDE figures in November coming out. However, they did not change enough that it makes a whole lot of difference in his thinking, and he really went through the process of explaining what he sees in 2019 for both corn and soybeans as it's related to supply. Here's Bill Turney from Ag Resource Company.
Well, let's start off with, I think the good news. The good news is that I think we've seen the low in the corn market. I think the USDA's expectation of record U.S. corn exports on top of last year's record U.S. corn exports, I think that's a reasonable expectation. However, I'm a little bit concerned that the pace of global corn exports really doesn't match the expectation. Last year, at this time, in the month of October, we had, I think, about 11 million metric tons of total corn exports, the principal exports. This year, we're about 11.2. So I would like to see the pace of total global corn exports pick up, because it's anticipated that if demand is as strong as USDA says it is, it's going to come to the United States. And I think it's that demand plus seasonal factors that's likely to pull up corn prices and hopefully give farmers some better pricing opportunities for the 2019 crop. It's anticipated that next year's corn seedings will be up from this year. It's anticipated that corn exports will be down because we're looking at the likelihood of very large South American crops that will be competing with U.S. corn next fall. So if we see very strong exports out of South America next fall and we see larger U.S. corn seedings, I think we're going to see lower U.S. corn prices next fall than we saw this year. But between now and then, I think prices are going to be going up, old and new crop, and that should give farmers an opportunity to do some pricing of the 2019 crop.
I'll repeat that because it's important. Your view is that if you're going to market the 2019 crop, maybe better sooner rather than later, depending on what happens with, in particularly, the Brazilian Safrina crop corn. You gave us an acronym during the presentation, ABU, which stands for Argentina, Brazil, and Ukraine, and is related to corn on the global stage. Why do you pick those three countries?
Well, in 2012, Brazil was the world's largest corn exporter. If you take a look at Argentina, Brazil, and the Ukraine, I think three or four out of the last 5 years, they've had over half of the total world's U.S. corn, world's corn exports. And that's a relatively recent phenomenon. We have clearly seen South America become the dominant exporter of soybeans and soy meal. And certainly wheat producers have seen, certainly since 2001-2002, we've seen a shift in the relative importance of the U.S. as a wheat exporter. Back when I first started in this business back in 1981, the U.S. was the world's largest exporter, accounting for roughly 55, maybe 57% of total wheat trade. The former Soviet Union was the world's largest wheat importer, and we totally reversed that situation. In several of the last 3 to 5 years, the U.S. has only been the fourth largest exporter, even smaller than Canada. So I think there's a lot of long-term pressure on U.S. corn sector from increasing competition from, as I said, the ABUs, with a lot of that competition coming from Brazil. But I also want to point out a very significant expansion of production in the Ukraine. This year, the Ukraine is expected to have a record crop and record exports, and it may well be that the USDA is underestimating the size of this year's Ukrainian crop.
How does the reallocation of the export market for any particular commodity happen, in your opinion? And is it a slow process, or is it kicked off by events?
All right. In the case of 2012, the reason why Brazil was the world's largest exporter was because in the United States, we suffered the worst drought in 50 years. We just didn't have the corn to sell. At the same time, Brazil had, I think, a record crop and certainly very attractive prices. So if the prices were high enough and you have the supply, then you get market share. But you bring up a very interesting question, and I'd like to have our listeners perhaps check out some documents on University of Illinois' FarmDoc. There is a series of publications been done over the last several years on international comparisons of costs of production on the FarmDoc website. I think the lead author is a faculty member at the University at Purdue. His name is Michael Langemeyer. If you take a look at those, they look at costs of production and returns for corn, soybeans, and wheat from the world's principal exporters, the European Union, Ukraine, Russia, Brazil, Argentina, Canada, the United States, and I think they even look at Iowa and Illinois returns. You'll see that relatively consistently over time, the U.S. has not been the low-cost producer, and U.S. farmers have not received the highest net returns. We've seen very good returns to corn and soybean production in Brazil and Argentina that clearly has incentivized increased production there. So for a variety of reasons, one of which includes currency exchange, currency changes. Lower currency makes it more profitable. A higher currency makes it less profitable. So part of the burden that U.S. producers have had to shoulder is in part due to a strong dollar, part of the advantage that Russian farmers, Brazilian farmers, Argentine farmers have had in terms of the overall profitability of crop agriculture has been due to their weaker currencies. So some of it has to do with purely agricultural economics, cost of land, cost of labor. Some of it has to do with macroeconomics, which drive changes in currency exchange rates. Some people have said that U.S. agriculture won't recover in a significant way or achieve improved competitiveness until the value of the dollar goes down. And that's a question that you'll have to put to a macroeconomist, and I'm not one of those.
Well, let's stay with stocks to use then, but switch to soybeans, because whether you're talking about the U.S. supply or versus demand or the world supply versus demand, this is an ugly situation.
Well, it is. We have a record crop for soybeans in this year. USDA is projecting we're going to have record absolute ending stocks. We've never had stocks this large. And in terms of stocks to use ratio, you have to go back some 25 years to find a time when stocks to use were projected to be this large at this time of year. If you broaden your perspective a little bit and say, well, since South America is so important, the dominant producer of soybeans and soy meal, the world's largest exporter of soybeans and soy meal, what if we include South American stocks in the analysis? Well, if we look at combined stocks to use of the United States, Brazil, and Argentina, which represent 92% of total global soybean and soy meal trade, those three countries are expected to have record stocks as of the end of January of this year. I picked the end of January because that's just before February 1, which is the beginning of the marketing, local marketing year for Brazil soybeans. And I think it's April 1 or March 1, which is the beginning of the marketing year for Argentina. So just before The majority of the world's soybeans are harvested. We are expecting to see over 100 million metric tons of stocks available in those three countries. And then you add on top of that what is currently projected to be a record South American crop. So I'm very concerned that record supplies and near record stocks to use ratios are likely to mean significantly lower soybean prices than what we have now if we don't see a resolution of the trade dispute between the U.S. and China.
So it is possible, and you do this, others do this fairly often, to take that supply and demand and put it into some curves and come up with some projections. What do they show?
Well, one of the better performing price models, and I say better performing in terms of its statistical properties, is to look at how low January soybean futures get in October, December, relative to how large the G3 stocks are. By G3, I mean U.S., Brazil, and Argentina. That model suggests that with expected stocks, we could see soybean prices well below the $7 level, simply based on supply and demand relationships as we believe them to be now. If, however, we get a trade agreement, I think we could probably get up to the $10.50 level on basis January futures. So if President Trump and if President Xi of China do arrive at a resolution, which includes a lifting of the tariff, a lifting of the implicit embargo on U.S. soybeans, and perhaps even a commitment from China to buy even more U.S. soybeans, then I think we've seen the low in the market. Without that, I think these huge stocks that we have and anticipate having are just going to push prices lower.
How important is that last part of your sentence, not the without that, but the commitment part, the commitment of a purchase to a trade agreement to make things happen?
I leave that up to the market to weigh President Xi's commitments in a trade agreement. Maybe the market will take him at his word and say, if they say they're going to buy X amount of soybeans from the United States, in addition to the U.S. traditional market share, which is roughly 35% of their imports, if they say that, then we'll take him at his word. If, on the other hand, the market says, well, I won't believe the sales until I start seeing the sales appear in the export sales report.
And finally, just to recap that, the upside potential, not nearly as great as the downside losses at this point.
Again, it depends on what level of commitment China makes by crop and over what time period. Some people have said that, well, China will make a commitment if prices are competitive. Well, that doesn't really improve U.S. competitiveness relative to Brazilian. But if China waives the if prices are competitive clause, if they waive that and say, we will import X number regardless of price, then clearly U.S. soybeans will be in a very advantageous position.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You're welcome.
Bill Turney is with Ag Resource Company out of Chicago, Illinois. I spoke with him during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention earlier in the month of November. In fact, the week that the United States Department of Agriculture updated the crop production and world agricultural supply and demand estimates. That estimate after I had talked to Turney, but not really having an impact on what he had to say and what you've just heard, changed dramatically the number of bushels of corn that were available around the United States based on some figures that the Chinese government also released that week. The global stocks of corn went from 159.35 million metric tons in the month of October to 307.51 million metric tons in the month of November. For context, that's about 12.1 billion bushels, but it was a 5.8 billion bushel increase. I asked the chair of the World Agricultural Outlook Board, Seth Myers, about the increase and why the numbers from China were included in this particular report.
The numbers were from the third annual census from the National Bureau of Statistics in China. So, and to be clear, what they published was area and production. That's all they published, area and production. Okay, so of course, that's not a complete balance sheet, but that's what they published. We have historically taken the NBS data. You know, data from China are difficult. They don't officially report lots of data that we would like to see, like grain stocks. It is not easy for us to travel within China to do certain things. So data are in general a challenge in China. So we had a balance sheet with the official numbers for area and production that were published by NBS. The trade data usually are pretty good because you have two sources. You have the folks sending it and the folks receiving it, and they're generally pretty good, so you have an agreement. But the rest of the pieces of the data set, you've got to try and derive what you think is the right answer. And we had been maintaining what we liked for our feed use. But this was drawing down stock levels given the prior production numbers that the Chinese had had in place. Okay? Now, there are very few folks who do a global balance sheet. One of the other folks that do a global balance sheet is the International Grain Council, and then the FAO in Rome, the Food and Ag Organization of the UN in Rome. And so they had run into a similar situation where they felt like stocks were getting tight. Their choice was to instead say, hey, we think we have a good stocks number, and then they went in and reduced feed. We felt like we weren't ready to do that yet. We liked our feed path. And sure enough, NBS comes in with a huge production change. They basically found a year's worth of production over a decade. And we actually, not only did we keep our feed number, we actually had to raise it a little bit. Those organizations will have to go back in and revise. And I will note that, you know, we have the WASD report where we do the whole world. The Chinese publish a CASD report. And those folks have yet to, but will, go in next month and make those same adjustments on production.
Seth Meyer is the chairman of the World Agricultural Outlook Board, explaining the changes that USDA included in the November WASD, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, as it relates to the global supply of corn and just one nation, China, which more than doubled the amount of corn it says it has on hand, putting a full year's worth of corn in storage, over a 10-year period of production, but still a full year's worth of corn, some 5.8 billion bushels in total that USDA included in the global ending stocks. And Seth Meyer explaining some of the reasons behind that and how it actually fits into the USDA numbers being previously used as it relates to what they thought the Chinese were feeding. You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Look us up. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find most of our agricultural programming in its entirety.
It's National Peanut Butter Fudge Day. Marcellus Edson received a patent in 1884 for the milling of roasted peanuts between heated surfaces until the peanuts reached a fluid or semi-fluid state, and when cooled, according to the patent, reached a consistency like that of butter, lard, or ointment. On this day in agricultural history in 1820, a whaling ship, the Essex, was rammed twice by a sperm whale and eventually sank. In 1886, Carl von Frisch was born. A zoologist, His studies of communication among bees added to the knowledge of the chemical and visual sensors of insects. In 1906, Greenleaf Picard, a U.S. electrical engineer, was issued a patent for a silicon crystal detector, one of the first devices widely used for receiving radio signals. The detector was revolutionary in that he found that a fine pointed wire known as a cat's whisker in delicate contact with a mineral produced the best semiconductor effect. In 1967, the U.S. population passed 200 million, that according to the census clock at the Department of Commerce. And in 1969, DDT was banned for residential use as a part of a total phase out of its use in the United States. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, supporting the next generation of farmers with the Fresh Roots Young and Beginning Farmer Program, offering lending assistance and learning incentives to equip today's newest farmers for a healthy start in their farming careers.
It's time to define a marketing term. Commodity broker, analyst, and author of Mastering the Grain Markets, Elaine Cubb, joins us. She believes the key to profitable grain trading is building knowledge about the fundamental practices of the industry. Today, she helps us define the word carry. Here's one definition. Carrying charge is the cost of owning and storing a commodity during a period of time. The cost influences the difference between the futures price and the expected futures spot price.
Carry can also be thought of as the futures spreads throughout time, but they don't have to be future spreads. It could be in the cash market. Carry is the difference between the price now and the price later. Let's call it that way. So ordinarily, the price later will be higher than the price now because the grain markets tend to reimburse people who own grain and who store grain. They reimburse them those storage costs to keep, you know, an ample amount of grain or our inventories of grain from all flooding the market all at once. So there's built-in motivation usually for people to store grain because they will receive a slightly higher price for it later. That's carry.
And then how do you use carry when you couple it with another term, forward time frame?
Yeah, so, all right, let's say you've got grain in a bin right now. How do you know how long to store it? That's where carry comes in, is when you're calculating which forward time frame to use or which to plan on selling. And the way you do that is you figure out what does it really cost you to store grain for a month. And if the cash prices that you will receive 3 months from now do at least reimburse you for storing it those 3 months, or preferably pay you more than storing it for those 3 months, you know, pay you a good chunk of that what it actually costs you, then that's when you decide to capture that carry and hold on to it for that time frame.
And the cost would include the storage cost or what you might be paying the elevator to store, what you might be paying yourself if you have your own bin to store, and would include a time or interest payment as well on the money?
Exactly. You're right. If farmers are paying a specific storage rate per month to an elevator, then that's very easy to know. You know, they're charging you 6 months a month. If you're an elevator or if you yourself are storing this in bins, then yeah, you have to sit down and figure out what are your physical costs. What do you have to pay everybody to do this? Your insurance costs, like you say, the interest costs of deferring that income for a few months. That is a sort of hidden cost, but it certainly is calculated in. Particularly the big grain companies that are storing billions and billions of bushels. This adds up. Little bits and pieces of carry add up, and that's how they make a majority of their profits most years.
That's commodity broker, analyst, and author of Mastering the Grain Markets, Elaine Cubb. Today, she helped us define the word carry. A carrying charge, again, is the cost of owning and storing a commodity during a period of time. The cost influences the difference between the futures price and the expected spot month futures price. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.